You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Welcome to The Spear, the podcast about the combat experience, brought to you by the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm your host, Tim Heck, and today I'm joined by retired Marine Colonel Rick Jackson. Sir, thanks for being here.
Happy to join the team.
Well, we ask everybody, how'd you wind up in the Army? But in your case, how'd you wind up in the Marine Corps?
Right. Well, I'm a young guy from northern New Jersey, had gone to Cornell University, played football, was back trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life, and just determined, you know what? I want to join the Marine Corps and be in the infantry and do the things that infantry Marines do, and then come back home and work on Wall Street and make a lot of money. But I found out after I got in the Marine Corps, ooh, I like this and I'm good at it. I think I'll stick around for a little while longer. So I start out as a private going to Paris Island, having gone to Cornell and played football at Cornell, to then 34 years later retiring as a colonel.
So what was it like reporting to Paris Island, which most of our viewers or listeners will probably know from Full Metal Jacket or something like that, with an Ivy League education?
It was wonderful. There is not, I'll put it to you this way. I hated every single second that I was in officer candidate school. I loved every minute that I was at boot camp. And the reason is because the drill instructors didn't care what your background was. You needed to meet their standard and their expectation. And if you didn't, they were going to ensure that you did. They were on you every second of every day to make sure that you did the right thing for the right reason. And I just ate that up. It was wonderful. Those that could handle more responsibility, they gave more responsibility. But if you couldn't handle the responsibility and you just were a good follower, that was okay too. And I saw that right away from the Marine Corps. So I was going to boot camp with kids that were 18, 19, 20 years old, but I was 24 years old when I went to boot camp. So I was a little bit older also, in addition to having, had a pretty good education by then. But the drill instructors, it was clear that they cared and wanted us to be successful. And I said, wow, I want to be a part of this organization. So I loved every minute of boot camp.
So after boot camp and going to the School of Infantry, what was your first assignment?
Except I didn't get to be in the infantry. Apparently, needs of the Marine Corps determined that I needed to go to signals intelligence. So that's what I did. And it turned out that I was good at that also. So I went to ADAC, Alaska, after going to training in Pensacola, Florida, at Quarry Station, just right up the street from the Naval Air Station, where all the signals intel training is conducted. I graduated number one from my class at Quarry Station. So it gave me my first choice of billeting. So I wanted to go to Alaska. So I did, out in ADAC, which is in the Aleutians, closer to Russia than it actually is to mainland Alaska. And we would listen to things that you might think that we would listen to in the secret world out there. And it turned out that I was pretty good at that. And at the time, the commandant was looking for to increase the number of black officers in the military. And so they looked at, unbeknownst to me, at Headquarters Marine Corps, they pulled all the records of minorities that they thought might be able to make it through. And so they called me and said, hey, would you like to maybe go to officer candidate school and be an officer? And I still had that infantry bug in me. So I said, well, can I become an infantry officer? And the answer was, well, it doesn't work that way. You have to compete at the basic school. And so I said, okay, well, as long as I get a chance, I will do that. And so I went to, I got selected to go to officer candidate school, and I did. And then the rest is, I guess, history. I went to the infantry officer course, and then did my full career in the infantry.
The 1980s are back in vogue in military circles now, right? Large-scale combat operations, air-land battle is being discussed as the Army discusses multi-domain operations. What was it like being a young lieutenant in the 1980s as an infantry officer with a prior enlisted background and as a Black Marine?
Yeah, interesting. So in 3rd Marine Regiment in Kaneohe Bay, Hawaii, part of, at the time, 1st Marine Expeditionary Brigade, I was the only Black company grade officer in the regiment. When I was a company commander in 7th Marine Regiment in 29 Palms, California, then Colonel Mattis was my regimental commander. I was the only Black company commander in all of 7th Marines. And then when I was a battalion commander at Camp Lejeune, there were two Black battalion commanders in 2nd Marine Division and 2 MEF. So I guess things got better as we went along. And one of my fellow battalion commanders was just selected for Brigadier General, Tony Henderson. So I'm proud of Tony, and it was good to go. So the question, though, was what was it like doing operations back then? There was lots of training, and it was lots of fun. And I learned at the time about how we worked together as a combined team, both combined arms within the Marine Corps, and then joint service with the Army, because we did most of our training up at in the Kahukus near Schofield Barracks, right? So doing platoon operations, you would run into an Army platoon commander up there, and we just on the fly get together and do force on force. And we made each other better, because what we learned from the Marine side of the house was, wow, the Army is really good at their battle drills. If they can maneuver you into a position where they could use a battle drill against you, they were all over it. But the Marine Corps was more seat of your pants, flexible. Hey, let's just call an audible and do this. And if we could make sure that they never could maneuver us in a position, we beat them every single time. And so my takeaway from that was, wow, the Army has something to offer, which is we actually have to be good at the technical aspects of our craft, the TTPs, but still be able to maintain the flexibility of just the junior Marine that has an idea. Listen to that junior Marine and say, hey, let's try that, but actually have the skills and experience to be able to do the TTPs. So when you call the audible, everybody knows what they're supposed to do and where they're supposed to be. Best of both possible worlds.
After platoon command, where did you go, sir?
Right. So after platoon command, I went to be an instructor at the basic school. I didn't know necessarily why I got assigned to the basic school, and it wasn't until years later that the light bulb clicked off for me, is that the Marine Corps is very good at, well, I'll put it to you this way. Everyone that goes to officer candidate school is qualified to be there and be a lieutenant of Marines if they successfully make it through the program. But once you're there, everyone has unique talents and skills. And so when we talk about diversity, right, senior Marines are real good at picking out what their juniors are good at and kind of helping them get better at maybe the things they're weaker at, but really picking up on their strengths and focusing them and getting the use from what they could do to help support the Marine Corps. So I was, at the time, you know, you had to become a regular officer in the Marine Corps. And I went through that process, and I did very well there in Kaneohe Bay and was selected to get commissioned with a regular commission. And so I was assigned to go to the basic school. And when I went to the basic school, I worked down at Enlisted Instructor Company. And what we would do is help the lieutenants by providing the op for the lieutenants. So first I was the infantry platoon commander and then the weapons platoon commander. And then while I was also there, I was a staff platoon commander for one of the training companies. And so what I learned from there was that, wow, the Marine Corps does a really good job. So we have the longest entry-level training on the enlisted side. And then we also have the longest officer accession process. And it really pays dividends for the average enlisted Marine and the average lieutenant later on. Because the Marine Corps historically has been a young man's game, right? We want you to join the Marine Corps as an enlisted Marine, 4 years, 6 years, then you go home. Everybody can't stay. Same thing on the officer side. You do your four-year commitment, and then you go home back to your community, and somebody else comes in and takes your place. And then, you know, the system is designed so that there's an evaluation, and some people get to stay, and some people don't get to stay. So I was an instructor at the basic school. So that whole process of OCS determines whether you have what it takes to be a leader of Marines. The basic school spends 26 weeks teaching you how to be a leader of Marines. And then we send you to your skills school. So going back to the answer to your question, platoon commander, mortar platoon commander, fire support coordinator, then to the basic school, then to Suicide Charlie, 1st Battalion, 7th Marines out in 29 Palms, California.
After 1-7, you wind up in recruiting duty.
I did. Did not want to go. Went kicking and screaming. Battalion command in the other, that level of command in the other services is lieutenant colonel. And so recruiting duty is an 05 billet in the other services, but the Marine Corps makes it an 04 billet and then just rides you like a rented mule. And for the other services, it's a 2-year billet, but for the Marine Corps, it's a 3-year billet if you can survive, right? Well, the three COs before me never made it their entire 3 years there in Kansas City. And I had not been on recruiting duty, so I didn't know what to expect. And so the first 2 months of my 36-month potential tour, I didn't make quote-unquote mission, right? So I get a mission at the beginning of the month, and by the end of the month, first month, I missed the mission. Okay, get yelled at, as all Marines do. You didn't do what you were told to do. Second month, I don't hear from the district commander, who's a colonel. Didn't hear a word from him about it. But I get a call from the operations officer, lieutenant colonel. And he says, Major Jackson, how you doing? And I said, hey, sir, well, truth be told, I'm not doing so great. And he goes, yeah, well, how long you been here? And I said, well, sir, I've been here 2 months. And he said, well, how'd you do your first month? And I said, sir, I didn't make mission. And he said, well, how'd you do your second month? And I said, sir, what are you talking about? The second month just ended 2 days ago. You know that I didn't make mission. So what's this all about? And he said, well, Rick, my recommendation is that if you want to stay out here, that you don't miss mission again. And then he slammed the phone down. And I was like, whoa, whoa. So out of the next 34 months, we made mission 33 times, and we were Station of the Year twice in the rest of the time, because what I figured out was that in the Marine Corps, nobody cares how hard you work. As Marines, we're supposed to work hard. The difference is, have you done what you were told to do? If you can't do what you're told to do, if you can't accomplish the mission, then the Marine Corps will find somebody else that can accomplish the mission. And the only way I could accomplish the mission was to take care of my Marines. And that's where, as a major, so now this is 1996, 97. So I've been an officer now for 10 years, and I've been in the Marine Corps for 14 years, and I'm making a little bit of a transition to understand what it really means to be responsible for a mission that's important to the Marine Corps, not just a minor mission as part of a larger team.
So you've had a role in training. Yes. Now you've had a role in providing the raw manpower.
Right.
This all leads to combat in Ramadi.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's fast forward about 7 years and get to Ramadi in 2004. What's your billet? What's happening in Ramadi at the time?
Okay. So the march up already happened, right? That happened early. 1st Marine Division had rotated back to the United States, and they're in California. At the time, I'm not assigned to 1st Marine Division. I'm actually a action officer in the Navy Warfare Development Command in Newport, Rhode Island. I had been an advisor, just prior to that, I had been an advisor to the Royal Saudi 1st Marine Brigade in Jebel, Saudi Arabia. Actually, at the time, 9/11 occurred. So I was in Saudi Arabia on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So we finished out our time there, our year, and then I came back and I was assigned duty to Newport, Rhode Island. I had some buddies, some fellow infantry buddies, Lieutenant Colonel. One of them has just been nominated to be the next Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Eric Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Great, great Marine, great Marine. Well, he and another Lieutenant Colonel, Lieutenant Colonel John Freda, were working in the 3 shop of 1st Marine Division. And they were looking for individual augments to come with them back to Iraq. So they gave me a call. Both of them were on the phone. We were all on speakerphone. And John and Eric said, "Hey, Rick, we're going to Iraq. Do you want to come?" And I was like, "Yeah, I do." It was like amazing. It was so wonderful. So I was working for a Navy 2-star at the time. And, you know, it had to get approval from Headquarters Marine Corps. And Headquarters Marine Corps was happy to let me go. But they weren't going to backfill the billet. Right. So I went to see the Navy 2-star. And all he asked me was, "Rick, is this an important job?" "Yes, sir." "Do you want to go?" "Yes, sir, I do." "Okay, we'll see you when you get back." So it was wonderful. I got to go out to California and work with my friends. And then we went to, we did the build up. And you want to talk about how you prepare someone to go to war. I mean, none finer than General Mattis. He made sure that every single person in 1st Marine Division knew what it was he was trying to accomplish, what we were going to accomplish as a collective, what he wanted us to accomplish individually. He gave us the warnings, you know, to come back with your honor. Don't do anything that you might regret later on in your life. Go over there and do the job and then come back. And we went over and I was assigned duties as the Iraqi security forces. So you had 1st Marine Division. You had 2 MEF outside of Fallujah, right, where the 2 MEF headquarters was. And then you had the 1st Marine Division headquarters in Ramadi, right? And then you had the air wing, you know, where the air wing was at and you had the logistics at TQ, you know, all places that we're all familiar with as Marines out there in Al Anbar province. And then you had the battalions out, you know, some out and hit Al Qaim, you know, all the places that Marines are familiar with in Anbar province. But our counterparts were Iraqi security forces. So we had Iraqi 10 battalions, thereabouts, of Iraqi National Guard. And then we had Iraqi security forces that had the border guards. And then they had the infrastructure guys. And so they kind of, for support purposes, they kind of put them all together under a cell in the G3 called the Iraqi Security Force cell. And so we were responsible for the manning, training, and equipping of those Iraqi security forces. Okay, so how do you determine what it is that they need? Have you got to it? What's the training? If you recall, a little bit later on, General Petraeus came in and set up this whole training center for them and things like that. But this was still kind of early on, right? And so I remember my birthday was Fallujah 1, right? Then followed on by Fallujah 2. So we were trying to figure out how we could secure Al Anbar province with the minimum number of Marines that we had with us in 1st Marine Division, but then leveraging the border guards from the Iraqi security forces. And, you know, how do you protect the critical infrastructure, like the dam that was up north, you know, the critical sites, you know, governmental sites and that kind of stuff. And then, you know, were the National Guard battalions, were they prepared now to help you with combat operations, you know, and did they have all the stuff that they needed? And, you know, when you're looking at what guidance were you getting from the green zone, because if you recall at the time, we weren't allowed to give them heavy weapons, right? So they couldn't have heavy mortars, they couldn't have heavy machine guns. So that caused a little bit of a challenge in how do you prepare all of that stuff for war. You know, how do you go out to a meeting with the local political leaders and have the military leaders there? And, you know, what's the need behind the need? They may say one thing to you, but how do you figure out what it is that they really need? And then how do you come back to the division headquarters and then get all that support that's necessary? How do you convince the Pentagon that this is the stuff that you actually need? So you're right. All the training that I had up until that point had led me to that. And, you know, so typically, you know, what was a day in the life of Rick Jackson like? I would get up at 4 o'clock and I would PT. Marines always got to get their PT on, right? So at Camp Blue Diamond, no better friend, no worse enemy, do no harm, right? The motto of 1st Marine Division and General Mattis. So get up at 4 o'clock in PT, go into the office, then go to chow, then work all day, go out into Ramadi, have meetings with the Iraqis. There were 3 regimental size units under the division, right? So 2 Marine regiments and an Army brigade, which would be our, so we had RL, they were RLTs, so mm-hmm. regimental landing teams, so with all the enablers that you would expect them to have, which kind of make them equivalent to an Army brigade, right? So, you know, working with those guys, going out to see them, hey, does your Iraqi counterpart have what he needs? What is it that you want us to help train them on? Those kinds of things. Doing that all day, and then I typically went to bed sometime after midnight, and that was 7 days a week. 7 days a week from the day I got there until the day I left. There was never, I guess the only day off was a day when I had to go just get had a leak, a blood vessel leak in my eye, which I had to get checked. So that provided me with some rest. But that is typically what Marines do, right? That's what we do. You have a team working for you. You have Marine captains, majors, lieutenants, sergeants, gunnies, right? So what does a Marine lieutenant colonel do when he doesn't know the answer?
He finds gunny.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? So you say to yourself, okay, well, I have now spent 5 seconds thinking and the answer isn't immediately coming to me. So gunny, we need. And guess what? 100% of the time, the gunny will come up with the answer. Now, you may not like the answer, but the gunny is going to give you an answer that's feasible, acceptable, and supportable. So
we have a saying, mission first, people always. Yeah. That plays out for you in Iraq.
Yeah.
How so?
Well, how do you do the right thing for the right reason, and what results do you get? So when I was a captain and I was working at the basic school, I had a little interlude where for 18 months I was aide de camp for the commanding general of training and education command. I had two generals during my time as an aide de camp. First one was Brigadier General Brabham, who in the end retired as INL, or G4 of the Marine Corps, INL. He retired as a lieutenant general. And then my second one was then Brigadier General Fulford, who during Desert Shield, Desert Storm was Ripper 6 from 7th Marines, and retired as a 4-star general because he had gone to be the deputy at UCOM. So I had some pretty good mentors back when I was a young captain. And one of the first things that General Brabham had said to me was, "Rick, you're a pretty smart guy, but what I'm observing is you're trying to figure out the correct answer between right and wrong." He said, "But what you need to understand is I don't ever get questions directed to me where the answer is right or wrong. Because if there's a right answer, it was already decided before the issue ever came to me, right? I'm trying to mitigate wrong." I'm trying to mitigate, and I say wrong. He's trying to mitigate bad outcomes, right? Because if it was something right and good, that was already taken care of and already done. And so that helped me immensely when I went to Iraq and there weren't enough hours in the day to do the things that needed to be done. And there weren't enough people to be able to do them. And the outcomes were all bad or challenging. When I say bad, I guess I mean challenging. I mean, because, we're alpha type leaders in the Marine Corps. There's no problem that we can't solve. There's no mission that we can't accomplish. But some things are just unobtainium. And all you can do is just do the best that you can every day. And I told you that now General Smith and but then Lieutenant Colonel Smith and Lieutenant Colonel Frieda had asked me to join them in 1st Marine Division. I was struggling. Truth be told, I truly was struggling to do what General Mattis and General Kelly and Colonel Dumfort wanted to accomplish with the Iraqi security forces. I was truly struggling. And it was one night around 23:30, still working away, and Lieutenant Colonel Frieda pulls me aside. Gives me a soda. I love Coca-Cola, right? Gives me a Coke. And he says, "Rick, what's going on?" And I said, "John, I'm flailing. I don't know what to do. I said, there's all these requirements And I just can't get it all done. I don't know what to do. And he said, and what he said to me was, he said, Rick, let me tell you what your problem is. He said, you're trying to make sense of this. You can't. That's your problem. You are trying to make sense of a situation that is nonsensical. He said, just go back to being a Marine. Just chop wood. That's all you have to do. Chop wood. And it clicked for me. I immediately understood what he was trying to tell me. Stop trying to figure it out and just do the job. Just do the job. Stop figuring it out. Do the job. Help your people do their job. I'll help you do your job. Stop trying to figure it out. Just do the job. And he said it by saying, Rick, just chop wood.
So were you trying to figure out the strategic implications in the mess? And that was the problem?
No. I was just trying to figure out how am I going to get this unit the stuff they need in the time they need? How am I going to get this unit paid? How am I going to just, you know, first Marine Division is trying to provide security in Al Anbar province. General Mattis has a plan on how he wants to execute that, and it includes Iraqi security forces with help from Marine Corps forces. How does a lieutenant colonel and a couple of majors and a couple of captains and a couple of gunnies and a couple of staff sergeants make that happen with a mission order from the division commander saying, make it work? You have a book full of rules. You have all these regulations. You have all these people that you have to coordinate with. You have all these people that are screaming because if they don't get what they need, it could affect lives. And you're in a combat zone. And so how do you make that happen? In the end, you chop wood. You look at the problem in front of you and you solve it. And then you go to the next problem and you solve it. And you don't look back at the previous problem. You've moved on. You can't worry about, well, I was 50% successful, 25% successful. Just go on to the next one. And if you had a bad outcome, well, okay, I guess I won't do that again next time, right? And do they sometimes have negative outcomes? Oh yeah. Do people get killed? Yeah, they do. On decisions that you made or that you failed to make? Yeah, they do. And you got to live with that. But the mission, the job still has to get done, and the mission still has to get accomplished. And to do the right thing for the right reasons is to make sure that, just like General Mattis did, we're going to make sure that everybody is trained. We're going to make sure everybody knows their job so that when bad things happen, we can just say, S happened, right? It was, you can have whatever investigations you want. The truth of the matter is that everybody was trying to do the right thing for the right reason. On this particular occasion, something bad happened, but on 20 other occasions, something good happened, and we're just going to move on. We're going to try to learn the lessons, and we're just going to go on to the next day's business. We're just going to go on to the next day's business. Yeah.
You're a shop chief or a section head. How do you translate that chop wood mentality to your subordinates?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. And again, that goes back to recruiting duty. Marines will work their tails off for you if they're sure that you care about them. And sometimes they will take on more than they're actually capable of. So you got to keep an eye on that. And so you can't be looking for things for them to take things off your plate. You need to look for things to help facilitate them being able to execute the things that are on their plate. And that means that you can't be separate from them, right? You have to be intimately familiar with everything that they are planning, that they're planning to do, that they want to do, that they're struggling with. You know, something that might take them a half a day, if you could just make one call to the green zone, 1 5-minute call to the green zone, and save them a half a day's worth of work, well, that Marine's not going to tell you that he's struggling maybe until days later, right? So you have to keep your finger on the pulse of what's going on just by having your stand-up meetings, you know, walking around, right? What did General Krulak always say? Management by wandering around, right? So I happened to be, when I was a staff platoon commander at the basic school, right, way back when, General Krulak happened to be the CG of McCitic. So I could be getting changed from PT in my office, right? And the door opens up and General Krulak walks in. You know, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. Hey, Rick, how's it going today? What do you have going on? Well, sir, I got this. Okay, if you need anything, let me know. I happened to have General Zinni, later CENTCOM commander, as my regimental commander when I was a platoon commander, out firing mortars in the central training area in Okinawa. You turn around, and there's Colonel Zinni, the 9th Marine Regimental commander and the Sergeant Major, saying, hey, Rick, what are you guys doing today? Hey, sir, we're firing a few mortars. Are you having any challenges? Well, sir, truth of the matter is, this doesn't make sense to us. You explain it to him, and he says, well, you know what? That doesn't make sense to me either. Sergeant Major, let's go back and check out why this is. And it turns out that there is no reason why it is, so we're going to change it. Mm-hmm. Company commander, Colonel Mattis, Friday afternoon, in the club. Colonel Mattis is not talking to his battalion commanders. He's talking to the lieutenants. He wants to know what they did in the field the past week, and did they have any impediments to getting done the training that they wanted to get done for the week. He didn't want to hear how good things were. He wanted to hear what the impediments were, and was there something that he could do to help smooth out those impediments. So I had some good training. So when it came time to execution in those stressful situations, I just fell back on the leaders that I had that taught me, hey, your job is to make sure that your Marines that are actually doing the work, that they have a smooth path to accomplish what it is that you want them to accomplish. And you can't do that by not being there with them every step of the way, not hovering over them, not saying, why don't you do it this way instead of that way? Let them do their job, but letting them know that you're there to help smooth the path for them for stuff that they can't get done on their own. That really helped me. I'll tell you, one of the biggest challenges I had was General Mattis, as the 1st Marine Division commander there in Ramadi, asked me to do something. He wanted some information, and I got the information for him, and it wasn't what he was expecting. And he said, no, Rick, this can't be right. So on one hand, he trusted me. He had known me for a long time. On the other hand, I gave him some numbers that he didn't expect. So he said, no, this doesn't seem right to me. Go back and check again. So I check again, and now I physically went to all these locations in Al-Anbar province. I physically went to the locations. Come back, sir, the number's exactly the same. Nothing has changed. And he said, Rick, it's clear that you don't understand what I'm asking for. Do you have a piece of paper and a pen? Yes, sir, I do. Give them to me, right? So he opens up my notebook and he says, this is what I want. Do you think you could get this for me? Yes, sir, I do. Out, battlefield again. Come back. It's exactly this. Nothing has changed, right? Now, he's got these responsibilities. He's going to use these numbers and he's going to talk to General Conway at 1MEF, right? Presumptively, he's going to talk to the head of the Iraqi, you know, what we're doing in Iraq. He's going to have to talk back to headquarters, Marine Corps. He's going to have to talk to the joint staff. So they need to know, he needs to have this locked down. And so I come back and I write under there the answer. And the next day he sees me and he goes, you have those numbers for me? Yes, sir. And I don't say anything. I just hand them to him. And one of my lowest days in the Marine Corps was when General Mattis, he says, it's clear to me that I have given you a task that's beyond your ability. I'll take care of it myself. You just go back to work. I was crushed. I mean, I'm 4 o'clock in the morning, going to bed after midnight, 7 days a week. I'm killing myself trying to accomplish the mission, making sure that my Marines are doing what they're supposed to do, all this stuff. So I went to see Colonel Dumford, chief of staff of the division. And I said, "Hey, sir, I think I let General Mattis down." He goes, "What's up, Rick? What happened?" And I said, explain to him, just like I just explained to you what happened. He says, "Are these the right numbers?" "Yes, sir, they are." He goes, "Okay, I got it. I'll take care of it." So he just got together with the three. They just confirmed that what I had said was correct. And then they knew how to talk to General Mattis. You know, as I look back on it, you know, as the years have gone by and I look back on it, General Mattis wasn't mad at me. He was frustrated at the situation. That's all he was. It was because he had a plan that he was trying to execute. And he was trying to, you know, he had some assumptions, just like we all taught. But you have to confirm your assumptions, right? So he had me try to confirm one of his assumptions. And I couldn't, right? I couldn't confirm the answer that he was looking for. So now he was going to have to go back and maybe reassess his plan and maybe go to a branch or sequel or alternative. I don't want to get into General Mattis's thinking about what he was trying to do. But as I look back on the situation, you know, but that was the lowest day of my Marine Corps career. But again, you know, you talk about good leaders. What did Colonel Dumford say? "Don't worry about it, Rick. I got it. You'll be fine. Everything's all right. You're good. And it turned out good. You know, General Mattis came up with an alternative to what I had told him. You know, so he, based on that, confirmed assumptions. He had it confirmed, not in the way he wanted, but he had it confirmed. And, you know, how did it turn out for me? Well, you know, 1st Marine Division gave me an award when I left. And, you know, I got battalion command out of there. So, you know, it turned out to be successful. But, you know, how do you got to do the right thing for the right reason. I mean, could it have been easy for me to just, I mean, it was clear after a while what he was looking for. But I couldn't give him that, right? I what's moral courage, right? You know, I can't have him make a plan based on a faulty assumption. You know, and that was just a minor thing, just a small part of it. He had much bigger issues that he had to deal with, but it certainly affected me. You know, not everything that we did was successful. Some Marines, you know, got injured. Some Marines, you know, didn't make it back. And, you know, a lot of Iraqis that we had made promises to, you know, they gave the last full measure also trying to support their country and doing the things that they were doing. But like all Marines, you know, you go in every day. What is it we say? You step in the batter's box and you give it a swing, right? And sometimes you strike out. Sometimes you get a hit. Sometimes you hit a home run. But you can't be afraid to stand in the box and face down the 95-mile-an-hour fastball. Not everybody can do it, right? But Marines can. And so, yep, you got knocked down. You know, you struck out yesterday. Next time, get in the batter's box, face the 95-mile-an-hour fastball, and give it the best shot that you can. So there's no guarantee that we're going to be successful. There's no guarantee that you're going to get command. No guarantee that you're going to get promoted. All you can do is step in the batter's box and take a swing.
You use the phrase moral courage, and most of our episodes deal with gunfights or IEDs. This is the perspective of staff leadership and having moral courage on a staff, right? It's General Mattis. It's the division commander. You know, I mean, he wasn't quite the legend that he is now, but he wasn't far off. How did you find the moral courage to say, "No, these are the numbers, sir"? Four times.
Right. It was, I think it was General Mattis himself, you know, earlier than that, General Fulford and General Brabham and General Zinni, you know, back when, right, I knew them when they were colonels, right? So, wow. General Fulford, first time I met him, he was a lieutenant colonel. He was the first MEB G3 when I was the 81 millimeter mortar platoon commander. So, you know, and I watching them when they were talking to their boss and giving their bosses maybe news and information that they didn't necessarily look forward to. Leaders can't make decisions with faulty information. And you're not doing yourself and you're not doing the Marine Corps any favors, even if it turns out to be negative for you, meaning that's not a good outcome for you personally. You owe it to the Marine Corps, and then more importantly, you owe it to yourself. You can't always determine what the outcome is going to be, but you can always determine what your input is going to be. And if you have a good leader, and you don't always have one, right? But if you have a good leader, in the end, maybe not in the immediacy, but in the end, they will realize, yep, he did the right thing for the right reason. And you will, and while they might not acknowledge, like General Mattis never came back to me and said, "Hey, Rick, sorry, you were right. Those were the numbers." He never came back, but he continued to treat me like a valuable member of the team. He didn't marginalize me because I had the courage to do the right thing and tell him what he needed to hear, the numbers that he needed to have, not the numbers that he wanted to have. And so you owe that to yourself, you owe that to the organization, and you owe it to the Marines, because suppose he had used faulty information and Marines had been hurt or killed as a result of that. Well, it gets me off the hook, but is that the right thing to do? How do you live with that? I always say that in my 34 years in the Marine Corps, there wasn't a day. Everybody has good days and bad days. Everybody. I don't care how good looking you are, how wealthy you are, where you live, what kind of car you drive. Everybody has relative good days and bad days. But I can truthfully say there wasn't one day in the Marine Corps that I wasn't happy to wake up as a Marine. And one of the saddest days of my life was the day I woke up and it was my retirement day. I did not want that day to come. So I look at that and I say, that's what I was trying to live up to. And we were talking about 1st Battalion, 7th Marines. Many people don't know that Suicide Charlie, 1st Battalion, 7th Marines, is the only rifle company in the Marine Corps that's authorized in regulation two flags. So they have the normal guide on, and then they have a separate guide on that's a skull and crossbones on a parachute flare, the parachute portion that's the white silk. It has a skull and crossbones on it that reflects back to the time at Guadalcanal on Bloody Ridge when the Japanese attacked, and they attacked through 7th Marines, and they attacked right into Charlie Company. And Charlie Company held them off with John Bassalone, a Medal of Honor that night. And that's the legend of Suicide Charlie, 1st Battalion, 7th Marines. And so each morning I would wake up not trying to live up to John Bassalone, but live up to what was expected of a member of Suicide Charlie. So not only was I a member, I was the leader. So I didn't have to try to be as good as all those previous leaders or as good as those former Marines. But each morning, as the CEO of Suicide Charlie, 1st Battalion, 7th Marines, I had to step in the batter's box and take a swing and do the best I could for the Marines, for the unit, for the battalion, for the regiment, for the division, for the MEF, and for the Marine Corps. And I think most Marines look at it that way. Just sometimes we need a reminder of that in the press of the day-to-day tough decisions that you, regardless of the consequences, Marines always will never go wrong doing the right thing for the right reasons. Regardless of the consequences that you bear, always do the right thing for the right reason.
Well, Rick, between chopping wood and taking swings in the batter's box, I think we've got enough physical metaphors there. So I want to thank you for being on this episode of The Spear.
All right, good to go.
That
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.